Church life before the crisis. Although, according to its heading, this chapter deals with past days, I will largely use the present tense, since I am really speaking about what is considered by most believers to be normal practice, and that from time immemorial. I remind you of the three New Covenant principles we need to bear in mind regarding the Ecclesia: its exclusive nature, the smallness of numbers, and the believers' participation in mutual edification. We must keep setting these three as a plumb line against current practice. Even though the concept of going to church to attend a church service was unknown in the New Testament days, for centuries the overwhelming majority of believers have simply taken it for granted that church services are the done thing. Believers worship God by going to church or attending church at the time of divine worship. While the first believers knew nothing of this practice, so strong a grip has attending a church service come to have on the minds of men, especially believers, almost anything and everything is turned into an occasion for yet another service. Wedding, funeral, harvest, Advent, Christingle, Christmas, Good Friday, countless so-called saints' days, Easter, Pentecost, baptizing, preaching, worship, family, guest, and so on, have all been turned into adjectives qualifying service. Such services are legion, mostly held in a location which is regarded, even if only for the occasion, as a place of public worship. What do most people understand by a church service and by worship? What is really going on? It goes without saying that there must be a very wide spectrum of answers to those questions, but even so, some common factors stand out. Although it will horrify many to hear it, even in evangelical nonconformist churches, when all is boiled down, most church services are in essence performances. Performances which are watched by 99% of the congregation, with minimal participation on their part, and that participation, such as it is, being of a liturgical nature, specified and institutionalized. Church leaders are in the main happy to allow the congregation to unite in singing hymns, songs, or psalms, perhaps to repeat some kind of liturgy, written or not, with maybe specified individuals performing delegated tasks, such as leading the silent congregation in public prayer, the reading of a designated passage of scripture, the giving of a children's talk, or taking part in or even leading the worship team or band. The climax of the service, however, comes when the congregation settles down to listen to the delivery of a monologue discourse by the minister. Cynically, but I fear factually, the climax for a growing number is the ubiquitous cup of coffee and biscuits, or something more exotic. As a result, most of the service is a performance by the few, mainly one, watched and listened to by the many, punctuated by an interval for refreshments. Indeed, even before the crisis and the consequent rise in the use of the internet, with the increasing use of technology, which has been getting ever more sophisticated, the notion of the service as a performance has been remorselessly gaining ground, as more and more preachers have chosen to read their fully prepared and documented discourses, often from an openly manipulated electronic device, used PowerPoint, and capping it all by the distribution of their sermon notes. The growth of the professionalism in all this has been so inexorable over recent years that it is almost certain to become the accepted format for many, and will soon be established as the next institutional tradition. Why is this? What is the driving force behind it? Could it be that an impeccable performance is wanted, not only at the time, but more especially for internet distribution? Things certainly give me that impression. Services are designed to run like clockwork. Presentation is king. Glitches are to be avoided, not only by the minister reading his detailed notes, but with his carefully orchestrated, programmed sermon illustrations appearing, as if by magic, at the appropriate moment on the public screen. The entire enterprise can then be edited to remove any remaining flaws, any going off script, before the whole is uploaded to the internet as a polished, seamless performance. But it must not be forgotten, the medium has a large bearing on, if not rules, the message. It won't be long, it is probably happening as I write, that church leaders will be consulting pagan TV producers to learn how to do it. If so, it will only be the latest in a growing list of such consultations. In addition, evangelicals have come to look upon such church services as the ideal venue for evangelism. Worship and evangelism are combined, with evangelism ruling the roost. This in itself has had a massive damaging effect on the life of the ecclesia. In particular, a deep-rooted inclusivism is now endemic, with believers and unbelievers joined in one service, the congregation being treated as believers from start to almost finish. What is more, the culture-led pressure has been rising to make the ecclesia and its message fitter to reach and communicate with the unchurched. We seem to be ignoring the biblical fact that the natural man, and the natural man is the sinner who needs to be regenerated, converted, and saved, not merely reached and communicated with, is by nature hostile to God and the gospel, Romans 8:7. The unchurched might well be finding the revamped church more attractive, but this is a far cry from being convicted as sinners and converted. It is possible to tinker with the gospel to make it acceptable to pagans, but will what is left be the gospel? To be able to communicate is commendable, but to communicate what? That surely must be our topmost priority in this area. Only the Spirit can effectively communicate the gospel, Christ, to the natural man. This, I fear, is being forgotten in the modern drive to understand the culture and accommodate to it. Before the crisis, such was becoming normal church life for many evangelicals. Believers attended the house of God for a church service. This is how God was worshipped. This was the done thing. And it was combined with attracting unbelievers into church attendance in order to evangelize them. All had to be performed as professionally as possible. It is time now to see how the Christendom Church matches the three principles I delineated concerning the ecclesia. 1. The ecclesia is, in the right biblical sense of the word, exclusive. 2. Smallness of numbers is essential for ecclesia life. 3. The ecclesia is for the mutual participation for edification of believers, each believer playing a full part. This is the essence of ecclesia life. Believers do not assemble merely to listen to a monologue, which large assemblies can cope with, but for mutual participation. I will not beat about the bush. On all three points, the Christendom Church fails miserably. In contrast to the principle that the ecclesia should be exclusively for believers, church attendance today is for everyone. How else can we evangelize the unchurched? In contrast to the principle of smallness, many churches place the endless increase of numbers in attendance near or at the top of their list of priorities. Indeed, the modern evangelical church's drive for a wide variety of well-run professional schemes demands a large congregation, which can supply the necessary wide range of workers to run the programs. The principle of participation by all, to the mutual edification of all, has been replaced by the congregation listening to a monologue discourse. The cost, the damage of these departures from Scripture is incalculable. It has meant that observation has replaced participation. Performance by virtually one man, or at most a few, has replaced mutual interaction, and the priesthood of a few believers, mostly one, has ousted the priesthood of all believers. This concept of performance, as many believers largely watch delegated people do their religion for them, makes it clear that many, most perhaps, have never really left Rome. I can best illustrate my claims by reference to the Apostle's words when writing to the Corinthians. He would not need to write to most churches today as he did then. 1 Corinthians 12, 1 Corinthians 14. Thus his illustration of the church as a body, each member of which is equally active, no passengers, all eager to encourage, in the biblical sense of the word, the rest, and, it is to be hoped, encouraged by them in turn, paint a realistic picture of today's churches. If we were honest in portraying today's church, would we not delineate a huge head, mostly mouth, addressing a mass of docile sheep? Allowing for the extraordinary, Paul was not rebuking the Corinthians for their mutual interaction, far from it, but for the uncontrolled carnal way in which they were going about it, breaking new covenant principles by their pride and self-centeredness. Stop your wildness, put an end to your pushiness, mortify the love of the sound of your own voice, and get down to real edification. This is what he was saying. What would he say to the average evangelical church today?